Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. As you know, because everyone listens to Mark Reardon on a regular basis, so you know Mark's in Vegas, but he should be back here in the saddle tomorrow from 2 to 4, just like always. But today, Brad Young sitting in for Mark Reardon, and not only do I get to fill in for Mark, but I get to talk to one of my favorite people, Amy Markscores. Hey, Amy. Welcome to the Mark Reardon Show.
Hey. Well, hey, Brad Young of Hairstyle Fisher & Young. You're one of my favorite people to talk to as well.
But, you know, I'm not used to talking to you in the afternoon. It's usually in the morning that we chat, and I've only had one cup of coffee instead of 15 like I've had now.
Oh, there you go. So I could tell there was a little extra pep in your step as you were making the introduction.
Well, yeah. I'm not the one that needs pep in my step, because you're the one that's got this huge fundraiser coming up on November 12th. Tell us about it.
Yes. Okay. I am so excited about this opportunity to raise money for the Backstoppers, one of my favorite organizations in the whole world. I'm sure the listeners are familiar with it. You know, the Backstoppers provides financial support to spouses and dependent children of first responders who have lost their lives in the line of duty. They also help the first responders and their families, the first responders who have been catastrophically injured in the line of duty. So on Thursday, November 12th, I am going to race the clock with a six-hour race. So I'm going to start the clock at 6 a.m., and the clock will stop at 12 p.m., and I'll see how many miles I can get in that time. For reference, wow. I'm hoping to run between 40 and 45 miles in the 6 hours, and people can donate during that six-hour time, but they can also donate in the weeks leading up to it, because we're only 2.5 weeks out. And I want to raise as much money as possible for the Backstoppers, especially since, you know, the Guns and Hoses event, which is a huge annual event for the Backstoppers. Well, there are no ticket sales this year. They're still having the event, and there will be, I think, 1,500 people, probably family, friends, and such, but not the general public ticket sales that they're used to. So I want to just help support the Backstoppers at a time that's been tough for everyone. So if you have the ability to donate, I'll throw out the website real quick.
Yeah, go right ahead.
It is backstoppers.org/AmyMarkscoresRun.
Well, and I don't want to skip over something. You just kind of breezed right by the fact that in 6 hours, you anticipate that you might run between 40 and 45 miles?
That is the goal. So there are different
goodness.
Kinds of runners. Yeah, you know, there are different kinds of runners. There are... That's exactly right. Yeah. You can be a sports car, like a Ferrari or a drag racer, where you're all about speed. And then there are the long haulers, the 18-wheelers. Mm-hmm. That's me.
That's
I'm
you.
An 18-wheeler. I just get up to speed and go all day.
I think I must be an AMC pacer then, because, you know, those big round vehicles. Because, listen, I was on my treadmill this morning for 2 miles. And, you know, I'm 2 miles, I'm thinking, hey, I'm doing a great job here. And then you're going to do 40 to 45 miles. That's crazy. I was reading just today, Backstoppers supports 170 families since 1959. They're currently supporting 80 families with 70 dependent children, and they provide roughly $2 million in assistance annually to the families of our fallen heroes. What gave you this idea, Amy, to do this run for the Backstoppers?
When Officer Tamaris Bohannon lost his life in the line of duty, you know, it had been just such a difficult summer, a difficult year for everyone. And you see him, and he was killed running towards the danger, right? Mm-hmm. And he left behind a wife and three young children. And it just absolutely broke my heart. And I don't want to take for granted the risk that first responders take every day. You know, when I go to work in the morning, you know, I sit in front of a microphone for a living. So I know I'm going to come home, but the first responders, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, when they leave for work, they know they might not see their families again. And yet they continue to run towards the flames and they run toward the danger like Officer Bohannon did. And I said this earlier this morning, but I was in a car accident last year, and within minutes, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, they were there to make sure that I was okay. And I want to help keep that promise, that the Backstoppers promise, which is a promise between the community and the first responders, that when they are catastrophically hurt or if they are killed in the line of duty, we will step up and help keep their families safe because they made the ultimate sacrifice to keep our families safe.
Yeah, I like the parallel here, and we're talking to Amy Markscores, you know, of the Charlie Brennan with Amy Markscores show every morning here on Camo X, weekday morning from 8:30 until 11. Most people just like to talk about doing things. You're actually doing something, but the connection that I like that you said a moment ago was that Officer Bohannon was running towards the problem. But in this instance, you too are running towards the problem, literally running to help raise money for these well-deserving families.
Well, again, it's my absolute honor to do so. And I've been running a lot, as you might imagine. It's just given me a lot of time to think about the officers and about the sacrifices they make, you know, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, but also their families. You know, their families know that what that husband or wife or mother or father is doing is inherently dangerous. So again, it's just a promise. And you talk about motivation for the miles. When I'm running, that feels like nothing. I'm just thinking about the motivation of keeping that promise to the families of our first responders.
Well, thank you for stepping up and doing this. And what's that website again, Amy, if folks want to contribute to the fundraiser, which is on November 12, if they want to help fund your race for literally a single person race for Backstoppers, what's that website again?
Yes, and you can donate now. We're taking donations today, tomorrow, every day you can donate. It is backstoppers.org/AmyMarkscoresRun. And I will post that link. It's up on Twitter and Facebook, but I'll continue to post that link as well.
Very good. I'll be going there this evening. I'm going to be making my donation just because I have to live vicariously through you, because if I ran 40 miles, I would be dead. So I can live vicariously through you, Amy. Thanks so much for doing this.
Hey, thank you, Brad. Thanks for letting me talk about it.
Oh, great. And I think I'll be talking to you tomorrow morning on Overtime.
That sounds good.
All right. Talk to you tomorrow. Amy Markscores, thanks for joining us this afternoon on The Mark Reardon Show. One of the things that you heard you heard Carol Daniel talk about at the top of the hour was that the Amy Coney Barrett nomination has moved now to the floor of the Senate. That vote will take place this evening. So coming up after this break, we're going to talk to UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh to talk about some of the issues that were raised during the nomination and the confirmation hearings and how her presence on the Supreme Court, I think it's a fait accompli is the term, but how her presence on the Supreme Court will impact Supreme Court cases for years to come. Brad Young filling in for Mark Reardon on Camo X. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. Brad Young sitting in this afternoon. And of course, as you've heard, and as I've been leading up to this during the show this afternoon, Tonight will be the vote for Amy Coney Barrett on whether she goes to the Supreme Court or not. And most of the analysis that you've been hearing has been talking about the political impacts. But I wanted to talk about the legal impacts. So I reached out to Eugene Volokh. He teaches First Amendment law at UCLA Law School. He's a frequent guest on network television where he provides legal analysis on constitutional law issues. And what's really interesting about Professor Volokh is that before becoming a law professor at UCLA, he clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I need to mention he runs a blog page. I read it every day. It's at reason.com. You can find it under Eugene Volokh or the Volokh Conspiracy. It's must see reading if you want an accurate and detailed analysis of court decisions with a nationwide impact. Professor Eugene Volokh, hey, thanks for joining us this afternoon on Camo X.
Thanks for having me.
The confirmation vote, as you know, on Judge Barrett will occur this evening. But during the confirmation hearings, many of the Democrat senators on the Judiciary Committee, they were focusing a lot of questions on whether Judge Barrett adhered to something called originalism, a view of interpreting the Constitution. So from your perspective as a UCLA law professor, what does originalism mean? And also, what would be the opposite of originalism?
Sure. So the premise of originalism is that the Constitution should be understood to mean what it meant to ordinary readers of legal language at the time it was enacted. So if you look at the First Amendment, it should be read with an eye towards how it was understood by the people who essentially ratified it in 1791. If you look at the 14th Amendment, it should be understood the way that it was written in 1868, which is when it was adopted. And likewise for statutes, that a statute enacted in 1950 should be understood in terms of the legal language of that era.
The other
originalism,
question is,
I think most justices have found original meaning to be an important thing to consider. Liberal justices, such as Justice Brennan, for example, would often cite original meaning. Some justices think that original meaning should be the dominant approach, although then there's, of course, a complicated question of what do you do with precedent that may depart from original meaning, but you can't really have a legal system in which every precedent is subject to being revisited whenever an original meaning argument is made. The antithesis is what I suppose is sometimes called the living constitution model, which is that justices should feel freer to implement what they think is the right view of what the law ought to be, at least so long as it is consistent with some possible understanding of the text. Again, most justices have considered that, at least in some measure, in some situations, although some justices basically categorically reject that in favor of originalism.
Well, I read once where Justice Scalia said, quote, "The Constitution is not a living organism. It is a legal document. It says something and doesn't say other things," unquote, which sounds pretty clear. Where does Judge Barrett fall down on this idea of originalism?
So it's hard to tell for sure. I think she has a lot of sympathies with originalism, but even Justice Scalia had at times recognized that certain kinds of precedents had been really quite well settled for a long time, and that that's something that you can't really easily undo. So my guess is she's going to take seriously original meaning in certain situations, but in most cases, the great bulk of cases, she's also going to consider very seriously the precedents that have developed. Well, let's take one example, free speech law. The original meaning of the free speech clause is not particularly clear. That's one problem, which I think even originalists recognize, is that some things just weren't terribly well settled in 1791. But what's more, we've had 100 years of very active work by the Supreme Court in trying to develop the law of free speech, and it seems very unlikely that justices are going to try to go back to the original meaning when it means overturning decades of precedent that had been pretty broadly accepted. So I think it varies from context to context, but I do think she's going to take original meaning quite seriously.
Well, you mentioned free speech, and of course we're talking to UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh, and you mentioned free speech, and this actually came up in the confirmation hearings, and Judge Barrett was asked about how the First Amendment freedom of speech is applied to the states, and this is what she said.
The 14th Amendment, which is the context in which the state action requirement has been explored in Supreme Court case law in the civil rights cases, means that the equal protection guarantee or even all the Bill of Rights that are incorporated through it, like the First Amendment, only apply to the government. So when I'm teaching this to my con law students, what I tell them is that I can tell my kids at the dinner table, the First Amendment doesn't apply here. They'll often say, like, hey, what about my freedom of speech? And I'll say, you don't have any, because in my house it is the law of Amy. So, but public universities, you know, are different than private universities in that regard, because the First Amendment applies to government-run institutions, but not to private universities.
Yeah.
Professor Volokh, I want to follow up with you on this. Do you see any free speech issues on college campuses today? And is there a constitutional difference between a public university that may squelch political or religious speech versus a private university that does the same thing?
Yes, Judge Barrett was absolutely right. There is all the difference in the world for First Amendment purposes. Public universities run by the government are subject to the First Amendment and other constitutional constraints. Private universities are not. And that's true, by the way, even if they get government funding. The question for constitutional purposes is not whether there's any funding given, but rather who makes the decisions. And if a private university says we want to expel students for what they say, that's not a First Amendment problem. Now, that may violate, I think, important norms of academic ethics and
Certainly.
Academic freedom. It may violate contracts that the universities have entered into. For example, in the student handbook, they say we respect student academic freedom and student free speech. It may be a breach of contract for them to expel someone then. California, actually, my own state, has a state statute that limits private universities' ability to restrict student speech. I don't think any other states have that, though. Private universities are generally subject only to kind of their own sense of academic ethics, coupled with public opprobrium if they unduly abridge speech, and possibly the kind of contracts that they enter into.
Well, free speech is certainly on the front burner, and one of the topics that you've covered at the Volokh conspiracy just last week was a case in Pennsylvania school district that instituted a new policy that bans all political speech at schools. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to get into that, but the point being is that you see free speech as an issue going forward, certainly even after the vote this evening on Judge Barrett.
Well, of course, there have always been huge free speech disputes, but especially when it comes to universities, there have been many more in recent years than there had been before. So there are going to be lots more in the years to come.
Very good. Hey, Professor Eugene Volokh, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon on KMOX.
Thank you.
One of the issues that we'll probably get into, hopefully before the show is over this afternoon, is this idea of free speech at schools. What is allowed? What isn't allowed? And that's one of the fascinating topics that I wanted to get into with Professor Volokh, and I'm glad he could join us this afternoon. Brad Young filling in for Mark Reardon this afternoon on KMOX. We'll be back right after this.
Tying run at the plate. Trinan. Got him, and the Dodgers win.
That's Joe Buck breaking down the game. The Dodgers and the Rays played Game 5 of the World Series last night. Our own Kevin Wheeler is here to give us a rundown of the game last night. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the Mark Reardon Show.
Good to be with you, man. How's everything going? You enjoying the series?
Oh, we're having a great time this afternoon. And what I wanted to talk to you about, though, is Clayton Kershaw, you know, he's typically had a less than perfect postseason reputation. But how did he do on the mound last night?
He did a pretty good job. You know, he's actually had a number of games where he's been really good for a period of time, and then they kind of leave him out there a little too long, and that's when the game gets away from him. But they didn't do that last night. You know, they got to a point where some of the, even though he recorded three outs in a row in the sixth inning, the ball was hit pretty hard against him, and they made the move to go to the pen. And look, I mean, this guy's already a Hall of Famer. He's already one of the greatest left-handed pitchers of all time. And for me, anyway, as a fan of the game, I like seeing him get this opportunity for his team to win the World Series without him having to carry that load of being considered a guy that doesn't get it done in the postseason.
Yeah, it's been a lot of years since the Dodgers have clinched the ring.
Yeah. So to put it into perspective, the last time they won the World Series, I was a sophomore in high school. So I mean, we're talking about a good ways back in 1988. And,
wow.
You know, you look at Kershaw, right? Like, Kershaw is a longtime veteran. Right? He's been around forever. The team is in the playoffs every year, so he's had a lot of postseason experience. Last night, he became the all-time leader in strikeouts by a pitcher in the playoffs. The crazy thing is he's only 32.
Amazing.
So he came up at such a young age, you know, around 20, 21 years old, that it feels like he's been around forever. But he's like 6 years younger than Adam Wainwright. You know, I mean, this is a guy that actually probably has a good, you know, pretty good chunk of his career left.
Well, you know, last night's win, I think, is even more impressive in light of Saturday night's game. And let's talk about Game 4 on Saturday night for just a moment. Easily one of the wildest World Series finishes that I have ever seen. So let me set up the question for you, Wheels. Bottom of the ninth, the Dodgers are up 7-6. Brett Phillips is at the plate for the Rays. What happened?
Well, the first thing that happened was Kenley Jansen, the closer for the Dodgers, missed his spot by about a foot and a half. So instead of a pitch being up and out of the zone, which is where the catcher was asking for it, he threw it basically right down the middle on a 1-2 count. So Phillips hits kind of a medium line drive into center field, and they don't have their regular center fielder in there, Cody Bellinger, because he had back spasms before the game. So, and he's a Gold Glove finalist, so they don't have their Gold Glove candidate center fielder in there. So they have Chris Taylor, who's kind of a utility guy. He kicks the ball, and while he kicks the ball, the base runners that are on are all continuing to run. And as he throws the ball home, Randy Arozarena coming around third trips and falls. So he's about halfway between third and home, laying on the ground trying to scramble to get up. But the catcher misses the throw from the cutoff man, who was the first baseman. And Arozarena gets to get up and cross the plate. And I'll tell you, I coach younger players. I coach 14-year-olds. And that's the kind of stuff we see throughout the summer at the younger ages. To see it in the World Series was just phenomenal and crazy and hell of a lot of fun, to be honest with you.
Oh, it was amazing. And so, but here's the question I have. If the Dodgers catcher, Will Smith, if he had caught that throw from the cutoff man, do you think he could have tagged Arozarena?
Well, if he catches that throw, Arozarena's out. He's out by, well, let's put it this way. He's either out by 20 feet or they're going to be in a rundown somewhere between home and third going back and forth. And I get it. You know, it's a tough play for a catcher because you don't see where the base runner is. Like, he doesn't know that Arozarena fell. So he's trying to catch and turn and make a sweep tag kind of all in one motion because he thinks the runner's bearing down on him. On top of all of those things that I just described that went wrong, you also have the pitcher, Kenley Jansen, who wasn't backing up the play, which is where he was supposed to be. So if he's backing up the play, he may just catch the wild throw, and then you still have the runner in between and a chance to get him out. So, you know, I think, you know, and I'm a catching instructor and a former catcher, so I'm going to side on Will Smith. He had the difficult play there, and he had to kind of try to do everything all at once. And once that fell apart, you know, you need everybody else to be where they're supposed to be. And didn't happen there. And obviously, you know, if you're rooting for the Rays, it made you happy.
Yeah. We're talking to Kevin Wheeler. And you mentioned about whether or not Smith actually saw Arozarena trip and fall. And it was obvious that he didn't because he kind of did the sweep tag. How would he have played that differently?
Right.
How would he have played that differently had he been able to see Arozarena tripping and falling when he rounded third?
Well, I mean, there's the most likely thing is he just slows everything down. So if you knew, and it's really hard to, you know, at that point when the throw is coming from a cutoff man that's only about 80 feet away from you, you don't have the time left to take one more peek to see what's happening with that runner. Because normally as a catcher, you know, as the play is developing, you're kind of peeking back and forth, right? Your eyes are on the ball, but you're also going to take a look at what the runner is doing as well. But at that point, there would have been no time for it. And if he had known, if he had been able to see, at the very least, he could have thrown his body in front of the ball to make sure it doesn't get by. And then you have the player in a rundown, or he's just going back to third safely, which in that scenario is not the end of the world, right? I mean, the game's still alive if that's sure. the scenario. But unfortunately, it was so quick, happened so quick all at the same time, he didn't have a chance to see that.
It was amazing. Was he charged with an error? Was Smith charged with an error for that?
I think he was after the later on after the game, and I mean I understand it. I mean, it was a ball that he probably should have caught, and he missed it. So you know, I certainly don't think it was an error on the relay man, on Max Muncy, the first baseman. I think the throw was catchable. I think the problem came in when he tried to act too quickly.
Wow, what an amazing finish. And the other part, of course, you already mentioned Randy Arozarena, and boy, he has been on fire. In fact, here's what Joe Buck had to say about Randy Arozarena.
Here is a shot into right center field. This ball is back at the wall, and he's got another. And the all-time record for home runs in a single postseason with number 9. More importantly for the Rays, it's a 2-1 game.
What a call. How impactful, Kevin, has Arozarena been for the Rays this season?
I mean, he's arguably the single most important reason why they're even in position to play game 6 tomorrow. I mean, throughout the earlier rounds of the playoffs, most of the Rays lineup wasn't hitting, but he was. And, you know, it's crazy to watch. I mean, here's a guy that, you know, had a little cup of coffee with the Cardinals in the regular season last year, was on the playoff roster last year for the Cardinals, but not used very much. And he missed most of this past regular season because he was on the COVID list, and then it just took him a long time to get back and kind of get an opportunity with the Rays. And yet, ever since the beginning of September, he's done nothing but hit. And this postseason, I mean, you think about the records. I mean, Joe Buck mentioned it. So he's got the most home runs ever in a single postseason. He's now got the most hits ever in a postseason and the most total bases. And all of this from a guy that has the equivalent of maybe 1 month's worth of major league at-bats in the regular season under his belt. It's crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, whenever I see Randy's name mentioned, or Luke Voit for that matter, it just makes me think of what if, because the Cardinals desperately needed some offense this year, and those are two great examples of people who've been generating fantastic offense. Now, let's get back to the series. The Dodgers lead the series 3-2. When's the next game?
So that'll be tonight. And it's tomorrow night. Yep. And, you know, that'll be game 6. And you know, I think what's going to be really interesting if you're watching game 6 and then possibly game 7 is which pitchers have anything left. Because all of the relievers have been repeatedly used throughout these first 5 games by necessity, because a lot of the starting sure. pitchers haven't gone very deep into the game. So, you know, basically we're trying to find out now is who's got just a little bit left in the tank to finish this series off. And the Dodgers in that regard probably have the edge because they didn't have to use a couple of guys yesterday. They'll have their ace, Walker Buehler, available for game 7 if we get to that point. So, you know, I think it's kind of the battle of attrition right now. And this is a particular problem for the Rays as, you know, their guys haven't been – their primary relievers have been used really heavily, not just in the World Series but in the playoffs up to this point. It'll be interesting to see if those guys have anything left.
Excellent analysis as always, Wheels. Kevin Wheeler. Thanks for being with us this afternoon on the Mark Reardon-less show.
Glad to do it. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, my friend. Hey, when we come back from this break, we're going to be hearing the cut of the day. We've got traffic and weather, so don't go away. Brad Young sitting in for Mark Reardon on Camo X.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
You know, it's tough during the presidential election to come up with a single cut to talk about because there's so many options to discuss. But one thing that I wanted to go to was just today, Biden was asked about term limits on the Supreme Court. And of course, tonight we've got the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation vote that will take place this evening, tentatively around 7 p.m. And so Biden today was asked about whether Supreme Court justices should have term limits. And this is what he said.
There is a question about whether or not it's a lifetime appointment. I'm not going to attempt to change that at all. There's some literature among constitutional scholars about the possibility of going from one court to another court, not just always staying the whole time in the Supreme Court. But I have made no judgment, my word. My word is about I've made no judgment. They're just a group of serious constitutional scholars, have a number of ideas how we should proceed from this point on. And that's what we're going to be doing. I'm going to give them 180 days, God willing, if I'm elected, from the time I'm sworn in to be able to make such a recommendation.
So Biden's going to get this recommendation from a commission to talk about whether Supreme Court justices should have term limits. But there's an enormous problem with trying to institute term limits for Supreme Court justices. And it's very simple. Under the Constitution, it's a lifetime appointment. So it doesn't matter what some blue ribbon panel of hand-picked academics say about whether there should be term limits. You can't do it. And so in this intense political environment, you're really going to get a constitutional amendment passed to place term limits on the Supreme Court? You know, I don't see that happening. What I would rather Mr. Biden, Vice President Biden, address is this issue of court packing, because we have nine justices on the Supreme Court and slots for nine justices. But that's not in the Constitution. That's been, in fact, it's fluctuated over the years in terms of the number of justices that have served at any given time. So one of the issues right now is if, because of the Amy Coney Barrett nomination being done so late in the political process, is whether or not a potential President Biden could pack the court. That's something I want him to answer, far more so than answering the idea of term limits, because frankly, in my mind, that's a non-issue. It's simply not going to happen. But a Democrat House, a Democrat Senate, and a Democrat president could easily increase the number of justices on the Supreme Court. If that happened, if that was going to be done, then that does not require a constitutional amendment to get that done. One of the other cuts of the day, I'm going to call this the bonus cut of the day, because, you know, frankly, sometimes we get just too much politics. Here is our bonus cut of the day.
Santa!
Mm-hmm.
We got a letter from David. He's already 7 years old.
Oh, hops.
Wow! But he's very concerned about this Christmas.
Ah, hello, David, and all the boys and girls. I have some excellent news for you. Christmas will not be canceled.
Now, that's a relief. I mean, think about 2020. I mean, that's the kind of point from the SNL skit over the weekend about the psychic and the Kate McKinnon excellent skit talking about what 2020 is going to be like. Boy, talk about a year that we want to forget. I am so glad that Christmas is not going to be canceled. Now, Christmas shopping hopefully won't be canceled. I know my kids are going to be expecting gifts under the tree, and I know yours are too, but what a year. And I'm hoping that for Christmas, and I'll tell you what I'm asking for Christmas, I'm asking for a better 2021. Brad Young sitting in for Mark Reardon this afternoon. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back. Twice, he's gonna find out.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.